Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's the largest man-made atom smasher in the world. 17 miles of tunnels straddling the French-Swiss border, buried deep beneath the Jura Mountains. Big collisions are coming, and scientists hope big new insights into the very structure of the universe. We're talking dark matter, black holes, the elusive Higgs boson, and maybe whole new space-time dimensions revealed. This hour, On Point, we'll look deep into the mysteries of the universe at the heart of the Large Hadron Collider. You can join the conversation. What are your hopes and fears for the Earth's largest atom smasher? What's the cosmic question you want answered when it makes its own Big Bang? We will talk in this hour with top physicists about what they hope to learn from the Large Hadron Collider, but let's listen just for a moment. First, outside of Geneva yesterday, workers at CERN, the European group that's put it all up, $10 billion, counted down in French and broke out in cheers as the first proton beam got on its way.
Deux, un, faisceau. Way!
Adrian Cho was there. He joins me now from Paris. He's staff writer for Science Magazine. He was at the European Organization for Nuclear Research, CERN, in Switzerland yesterday when they fired up the Large Hadron Collider for its first big test. Adrian, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom. Thanks very much for having me.
We heard the countdown, but it's not exactly got the drama of a rocket lifting off for space there.
No, it was an interesting event. I've never been to anything quite like it in my time covering physics. Physics doesn't usually draw huge numbers of reporters, but there were 300 members of the press there yesterday, and we all watched this happen from inside this kind of crazy building they have there, this big wooden sphere, which they call the Globe of Science and Innovation. And unlike the rocket launch, there's no big, plume of flame. There's no rocket ship hurtling into space. The accelerator basically looks the same running or not. But what we did get to see is essentially what they were doing was feeding protons into this big circular accelerator that goes the whole 17 miles around. And they were letting it go piece by piece through this. They had basically stoppers in the beam pipe at different points, and they would pull them out one by one and let the beam go farther and farther along to see if they could get it all the way around, which was, an issue of whether it had all been set up and tuned just right. So what they would do is they put these little screens in the beam line mm-hmm. that would fluoresce when the beam went through. And so they were in this huge control room watching these TV screens with these little flashes showing up on them, and then there were 300 of us inside this building, a few hundred meters away, watching them watch these television screens. So it was an interesting experience. There was this kind of very nice tension about it. I mean, when it finally made it all the way around, even the journalists were clapping. But it was a kind of different experience.
Stage by stage, it went around the whole ring, and that was no sure thing. A big step there, nearly $10 billion. They built it. We didn't, though there's $500 million U.S. dollars in there and some American scientific participation. But when this thing really gets going, it'll be closer to light speed or at light speed, and that's where the action begins. You say, Adrian, it marks the beginning of a new age of exploration. You quote Gordon Kane at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, saying that the Large Hadron Collider is a why machine. Why what?
Well, so, yeah, it is sort of the beginning of a new age for particle physics. Particle physics for decades, it's been the basically the same game, and the LHC continues this, which is that, you take subatomic particles, little bits of matter, and you smash them together at extremely high energies. And as we all have heard as school kids, Einstein said energy equals mass times the speed of light squared. So energy essentially equals mass. So if you smack these particles together with enough energy, you can generate new particles, heavier particles than the ones we see today, and these very quickly decay away, but scientists want to study those. And what Kane was getting at is that previous accelerators, previous atom smashers, have sort of shown us, you know, what sort of exotic particles are out there that, you know, can be made in these collisions, right? And you know, these particles are some way, they're kind of latent in the matter that we see around us, right? They're somehow etched into the structure of matter, even though they're not there on a daily basis, and you have to smash these particles together to produce them even for a moment. Somehow, what particles can be produced, this structure is somehow inscribed into to the structure of matter.
Particles that may be like particles that were around the time of the Big Bang or just after we read.
That's exactly right. Back when the universe was first born, as scientists believe, when it sort of leapt into existence and was very hot and very dense, then these unusual particles, you know, were zipping around for a moment right before everything began to cool.
Adrian, are you there? It sounds like he may have been zipped off into a particle accelerator there. Adrian Cho with Science Magazine with us from Paris and suddenly gone. Hey, we can crack the mysteries of the cosmos, but keeping a phone line across the Atlantic is not always a perfect undertaking. We have great guests to join us who are right in the heart of this whole business, though. Joining us now from Driggs, Idaho, is Leon Lederman, experimental physicist and director emeritus of Fermilab. That's the big atom smasher outside Chicago. He won the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1988 for his work on neutrinos, coined the term the God particle for the Higgs boson, what people are hoping will be illuminated by the new accelerator in Europe. Leon Lederman, thank you very much for being here.
Quite welcome.
How big a day, how big a deal, the opening of this accelerator, the first completed successful circuit?
Fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. It's a feat of technology, science, politics, luck.
Why did it happen in Europe and not in the United States?
Oh, I hate that question.
Sorry, but here we are.
Yes. The United States was on track to build the next stage. It had operated the Tevatron, the one that's still operating and probably at this moment technically still the most powerful accelerator in the world.
In Batavia, Illinois, the one you were in charge of.
Batavia, Illinois, mm-hmm. Just outside of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
It's still running. And the next stage of the consensus of the scientists all over the world who work in this particular field knew that we had to go another stage in energy. And so the U.S. proposed and hoped that it would also be constructed collaboratively with other countries, but we didn't really assure ourselves that. We went ahead. We had the support of three different presidents in the long course of seeking funding for this accelerator.
Put $2 billion into it.
We put $2 billion into it. It was 20% complete when the Congress of the United States, in its infinite wisdom, decided it was too expensive. We couldn't afford it and cancel the project.
And now the center...
Black day in October 1993.
Right. Now the Center of Particle Physics Research shifts when this thing gets fully up to speed to Europe. You know, you're the Nobel Prize winner. We're all looking on here and want to make sense of it. When you say it's a fantastic day, I mean, in your dreams, in terms we might understand, why is this so important? Is there a way to convey what doors may be opened by this huge new accelerator?
Well, I always look at that as a metaphor. An accelerator, you know, humans have eyes and a sense of touch and smell and sensory abilities, but clearly we're looking at objects that are either too small to see, too far away, too subtle to use human sensory abilities, and so we developed tools. So way back in the 1400s, there were things called spectacles, glasses, eyeglasses. People put them on in order to read the mm-hmm. scripts they were going on. And somewhere not too long after that, in the middle, late 1500s, a brilliant scientist by the name of Galileo heard or thought of the idea of taking these two lenses and instead of putting one over each eye, put them in line and in a tube and created what we today call a telescope. And with that telescope, which had the power of something you could buy in Walmart, so the Swiss equivalent for $10 or so on that, it was a weak one, but with in the hands of Galileo, he made fantastic discoveries. He discovered, in fact, that planets like Jupiter also have moons. In fact, he counted four moons, we now know there are nine, circulating around Jupiter.
Are we on the verge of comparable insights
That's
now?
That's the point I'm trying to make. The microscope, the telescope tool that he invented, uncovered an entire new world. He discovered that Venus goes around the sun, just as Copernicus had predicted. And the subsequent telescopes that have been made, and maybe the most famous is the Hubble telescope now out in space, has given us a totally new picture of the world in which humans live.
Leon Lederman, please stand by in Driggs, Idaho. We have more physicists joining us and a big new day opening up for particle physics and our understanding of the cosmos behind us, a wrap made to celebrate the occasion in Europe. This is On Point.
Exactly what they'll do in the LHC. You get matter and antimatter in equal parts. And they try to take this back to when the universe starts, the Big Bang. Back when all the matter exploded, but the amount of antimatter was somehow eroded, because when we look around, we see that matter abounds.
We're talking this hour about the biggest physics experiment in history, the Large Hadron Collider, cranked up yesterday on the French-Swiss border, the biggest atom smasher ever, and looking at what it may tell us about the Big Bang, the nature of matter, the structure of the universe. We've been joined from Driggs, Idaho, by Leon Lederman, Nobel Prize winner and director emeritus of Fermilab, the big collider just outside Chicago in the United States. It has been the biggest, but when this one in Europe is fully up and running, it'll be number two. We're joined as well right now from New York by Lisa Randall, theoretical physicist at Harvard University, author of Warped Passages, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Universe's Hidden Dimensions. Lisa Randall, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
We're joined from New York as well by Jana Levin, professor of physics and astronomy at Columbia University, author of the novel A Madman Dreams of Turing Machines. Jana Levin, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Lisa, first to you. You've done a lot of work with string theory and a whole lot more. Leon Lederman says, in a way, this is like this moment when it gets up to light speed and colliding at CERN is like Galileo getting his hands on a telescope. Begin to open the door for us as to what you and other physicists are hoping to see and learn in terms we might follow, even if we're not physicists, you know, sort of in order of, I don't know, likelihood and desire. What do you hope to see through this new tool?
Well, let's just remind ourselves here, because we talked about telescopes, and with telescopes, we see larger and larger objects. We see out mm-hmm. into the cosmos. With particle accelerators, we see something which is equally exciting but harder to picture, which is what's inside matter. What's the substructure of matter? What explains how matter has come to be in some sense, but also why it has the properties that it has? And mm-hmm. that's exciting for many reasons. So there's a number of questions. We started off by talking about the Large Hadron Collider being a Y machine. Well, what are the questions we want to answer?
Mm.
And I think it's important to keep in mind now that one thing that makes this particular machine so exciting is that it's not that we're looking for things that we know are there. There are some things that we do expect to be there, but there are other things that they're really open. We're going to find out mm-hmm. what's there when we see it. But we have ideas for that. So what are these questions? Well, one of the questions has to do with particles having mass, elementary particles having mass.
This is the Higgs boson business we've heard so much about.
It's related to the Higgs boson business.
Okay.
But the point is that elementary particles, we would think they didn't have mass, but there's only one really theory that explains how this could have happened. And it has to do with something called the Higgs mechanism. Now, why that's exciting from the point of view of the accelerator is that if this theory is right, which many people believe it is, there should be a Higgs particle or something like a Higgs particle, a Higgs boson, as you called it, that we should find. And it should be there, and it should tell us that this idea of how particles acquire mass is correct.
Well, and you're saying that would be the answer to how particles have mass? Is it mass that we can't now detect? And when you say particle in plain English, it would sound like, you know, like a piece of something, like it would have mass logically. Is that the physics logic?
Well, there's something in particle physics. Particles can have mass or not have mass. For example, a photon is a particle that communicates electromagnetism. It travels at the speed of light. Obviously, it communicates light. And it does not have a mass. From our perspective, it has, or if you like, it has mass equals zero, zero mass. Particles that we know about, other elementary particles, do have mass. And the question is, how did that mass arise? Where did it come from? And so we know it's there. It's been measured. It's well established, as you're saying. We do know these particles have mass. But the question is how to make that consistent with the other principles we know about that we're putting together theoretically. And that turns out the consistent explanation involves this extra particle called the Higgs particle. Now, the Higgs particle is exciting. But what makes it even more exciting from the point of view of particle physics is that it's not going to be just one particle that's out there. There really is an underlying structure that makes the whole thing hang together. And
you're talking
really
about the whole thing. You're talking about the universe.
Well, but I also mean the theoretical underpinnings of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
So if we didn't have some other structure underlying this Higgs particle, it wouldn't make sense. It would just all fall apart. So if we assume it's there, it's fine. It all works. But if we actually work out the consequences of quantum mechanics and special relativity, it looks like we would expect that mass to be much bigger than it is. So to explain why these masses are what they are adds a whole new ingredient, a whole new layer to this story. And that's where we really begin to explore the unknown. Could it be an exotic symmetry called supersymmetry, which is an extension of space-time symmetry? Could it be even that the universe we know about has more dimensions of space than we can readily see? And so it's answering those questions which really is going to give us some rich insights into the underlying structure of matter and even in space and time.
Jan 11, take us on in there. Lisa Randall and Leon says it's like a telescope. We're going to see things we've never seen before. Lisa Randall says instead of looking out, we're looking in. And yet we can hear right away that the implications here are huge. I mean, we're talking about space-time symmetry and, in a way, the fundamental structure of the universe. It's minute, but it's the structure of everything, even potentially, you know, we read here, opening doors to new dimensions of space?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when we talk about the universe, we're often using our studies of cosmology as a kind of laboratory to understand the fundamental nature of matter. And this is one of those times where that's being turned around by looking at these experiments that are probing the nature of matter on the smallest scales. We're going to invert that and turn around to get some information about the nature of the universe on the largest scales. And that's fitting because a lot of what Lisa was describing hinges on ideas of unification, this notion that it looks like the universe has all of these different forces at work with all of these different kinds of particles, but really it's one force, hopefully, that we'll begin to understand, and all the particles similarly can be unified into a kind of one particle. So an example that's often given is something like water and ice and steam appearing to be completely different phenomena. But, of course, we've learned to understand that really it's just this H2O molecule in different phases. And so that's a unifying idea. It's not that there's three different things, ice, water, and steam. There's really one thing. And it simply expresses differently at different energies. And this is what we are envisioning in some sense for our understanding of the universe, that space-time, high-energy particle physics, things like the Higgs boson, things that we are built out of, our bodies, the Earth, the planets, all of these things will be unified in a similar way. We'll find an underlying structure that, as Lisa said, makes it all hang together in a coherent way. So you can't do an experiment at this high energy and not be talking about everything.
Leon Lederman, help us with understanding a little of this. It sounds like the Higgs particle, the Higgs boson, is in a way a minimum of what people are hoping to find here, and I've read people hope to find much, much more than that. Lisa Randall says there may be an extension of space-time symmetry revealed here. Now, that sounds extremely grand and also hard to get one's head around. What would that mean?
There's a good metaphor we just heard about the higher the energy at which you, I think the important thing, the theoretical physicists, the two ladies who are with us today, do theory. They do pencil and paper and sleep late in the morning. And I work all
night.
Lifting up lead bricks and stuff like that. But there is an overriding quest for simplicity. I think Einstein said the world should be as simple as possible, but no simpler than that. And we're searching for this simplicity, and clearly we don't have it. The present understanding of matter and energy that came out of the whole series of accelerators from the time of Galileo with his telescope, a tool, to today, and this great big advance in our technology to settle many of the puzzles we have in our present model. We know a lot about how the universe works. We know it's 13.7 billion years old, and it began in a huge explosion with particles produced. And there are many, many questions along the way that we don't understand, and we don't see a simplicity. In fact, we see a puzzling complexity. And the little model that maybe we're looking at matter at energies which are too low, and at low energies you get complexity, but if you raise the energy, the simplicity emerges. And the metaphor of if you take ice, if you look at low energy water, it's ice and snow and liquid and also vapor. But if you raise the energy high enough, it's all simplicity. It's pure vapor. Everything else has gone away. And what we have is a simplicity. And so we're looking for that kind of simplicity. And the theoretical physicists are the leaders in pointing out what it is exactly that we don't know and what it is that we have to know. And Higgs is the first thing you hear about. We've been after the Higgs now for 20, 30 years, hoping to be able to clarify this by finding the particle that creates the complexity of mass. So that's something even the plumbers and electricians like my gang
can get their heads
around.
Lisa Randall, how about it? When you get that energy, and that's exactly what this 17-mile collider looks to produce, protons going at or near the speed of light, they bash into each other. It's been described as a little big bang that results. You say it's possible we would see an extension of space-time symmetry. People talk about opening new dimensions of space. What does that mean? Is that something you could walk through?
Okay, well, let me just take one step back for a second again and say that at one level, we're looking for simplicity, and that's certainly what theoretical physics does. But we're also looking for stability of what we have. That is to say, we don't want to be able to vary things by a small amount and see it all fall apart. And consistency, the fact that it all hangs together. And those are what tell us that there really has to be something that exists at the energies of the Large Hadron Collider. And it's also what motivates these very theoretical abstract ideas, because it turns out that it's not so easy to make something that is consistent. We know we can parameterize it, we can write it down, there's something called the standard model of particle physics, which tells us what exists out there, what are the properties and how they interact. But the question is, how do these properties come about? In particular, where does this mass come from? And so we know the mechanism for that, but we want to understand how it all fits together. And the point is that if we have this Higgs mechanism, we want to understand, why are masses what they are? Why aren't they so enormous that the universe would look nothing like what it looks like? Or another way of asking the question is, why is gravity so weak compared to the other elementary forces? And even though gravity might not seem weak to you, it has very noticeable effects, it's because the entire Earth acts on us. If you look at it with elementary particles, gravity is an extraordinarily weak force. And the question is, how is it consistent that gravity is so weak when the other forces are so much stronger at the energies we see?
Jana, we read here about uncurling dimensions of space that we're not currently aware of, that this what high energy activity in the new collider could actually sort of uncurl and open new dimensions in space and space-time. I'm not sure the right way to put that. What does that mean?
Well, there's different ideas about that, and in fact, Lisa's one of the proponents behind some of these ideas, mm-hmm. but we're used to living in large dimensions. We move our hands around, we wave our feet around, and there's this freedom. We don't, if those dimensions are not infinite, we don't notice because the universe seems so huge to us. And it's possible that these extra dimensions are actually small. You imagine the difference between standing on a ping pong ball or something mm-hmm, versus mm-hmm. standing on the Earth. Standing on the Earth, you hardly notice its size. But standing on a ping pong ball, it's very, very small. So in some sense, we're imagining that these other dimensions are so small that you can't actually stick your hand in them, so to speak, and mm-hmm. that in order to probe them requires very, very high energies, things that are very small and very high energy to begin to probe them. Now, that's not the only model for extra dimensions. There are some models where the extra dimensions are very large and where we find ourselves confined to a surface floating in this higher dimensional space, what's called a brain world, where we live on this brain, this like membrane. And the idea there is that I can't lift my arm off the membrane. I'm stuck to it. Mm-hmm. I move freely around in three dimensions, but in this other direction, I simply don't notice it because it just takes too much energy to go there. But with a high enough accelerator, we might begin to see things wobble off of the brain or in that direction. So it requires a lot of energy in either of those two cases to notice the existence of extra dimensions.
We've got a lot of questions coming in from listeners. I want to begin to turn to them, if I may. Some very simple. Let's go to Raven in Springfield, Vermont. Raven, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm just wondering, where do you get protons to make a proton beam? How do you separate it out of the rest of the atoms? How do you make it into a beam? Thanks.
Great. Thank you. Leon Letterman?
Ace Hardware.
Yeah, right, in the proton section.
Yeah, and they go to the protons, yes. You can buy a tank of hydrogen gas for, last time I remember, it was $20, and it lasted a year and a half. It's hydrogen gas. The hydrogen gas consists of atoms, and in the atoms are the simplest atoms we have. If you remember chemistry in the periodic table, it's in the upper left-hand corner of that table. The table that covers the wall, cracks in the walls of a billion classrooms. But the protons are the nuclei of the hydrogen atom. And so if you turn the valve and get a tiny stream of hydrogen gas issuing from that tank, you then make a spark, and the spark takes the electron away from the proton. And now you have bare, naked protons moving in some random direction, and then suddenly they will see a screen with an attractive potential, negative. We know that positives and negatives attract. Mm-hmm. And they'll head for that screen, and the screen will be at a high voltage. They might gain, say, 1,000,000 volts in passing from their origins to the screen.
What accelerates
them
to...
They go through the screen. Hmm. The screen is like, you know, mosquito netting. Mm-hmm. So they go through the screen, and now I have a proton starting on its journey around the LHC, but now at an energy of 1,000,000 volts, and you can direct it by magnetic and electric forces.
And are you pumping it up to near light speed by that voltage, or does it...
The voltage increases the speed, and you, in the sequence of accelerators, there, I don't remember the number at the LHC, but in our Fermilab accelerator, we have 5 accelerators in sequence. In each accelerator, it's like a music of rings. Each accelerator has an ideal acceleration. Like in a motor car, you shift gears. The faster you go, the higher the gear ratio you use. In the same way, you go from accelerator to accelerator until you get to the ultimate accelerator, 27 kilometers around it at CERN.
And Leon Letterman, hold the thought. We've got to take a short break here. We'll be right back with much more on the structure of the universe. This is On Point. Talking this hour about the biggest physics experiment in history, the Large Hadron Collider, LHC, cranked up yesterday on the French-Swiss border, the biggest atom smasher ever, and what it may tell us about the Big Bang, the nature of matter, the structure of the universe. I'm very honored to have with us Nobel Prize winner Leon Letterman, Director Emeritus of the Fermilab Accelerator outside Chicago. For a long time, the biggest, but no longer as this one cranks up. Lisa Randall, renowned for her work with string theory, theoretical physicist at Harvard University, joins us. She's author of Warped Passages. And from New York, Jana Levin joins us, professor of physics and astronomy at Columbia University, author of A Madman Dreams of Turing Machines. This is your chance to get all your questions answered, if we can do it, about that great big collider cranking up now in Europe. Let's go to Ferrisburg, Vermont, and Stephen. Stephen, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I have a pretty straightforward question. I've read that it's possible that there's nothing about the equation E equals mc squared that prohibits mass from existing beyond the speed of light. And I was wondering if that's possible, that that could be the source of dark matter. And I'm wondering also if this dark matter, whether wherever it exists, at whatever speed, if it could be found, could be used as a fuel for interstellar travel.
All right. Let's pick it up. Lisa Randall, let me come to you. Dark matter. People are talking about some insight into, first of all, what is dark matter, and how might this collider give us new understanding of it? And Stephen wants to know about E equals mc squared and mass beyond the speed of light and interstellar travel.
Okay, let's start with dark matter. So there's two types of dark energies in the universe. One is actually known as dark energy and one is dark matter. So what do we know? We know that there's a certain amount of energy out there in the universe, and we know how much of it is stuff we know about, like stuff that makes up stars and whatever.
Planets and stars and asteroids.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then there's other stuff which is clearly matter. There's clearly stuff that that has gravitational force. But it's not emitting light the same way as the matter we know about. And so it's dark matter. It's dark. And there's about five times as much of it as the matter that we've seen. And the question is, what could that be? And there's another question which has to do with dark energy, which is even more mysterious because that's energy that's out there that's not even carried by matter.
Okay.
But for dark matter, it's actually very interesting because there could well be a connection between the Large Hadron Collider and what they would find there and dark matter.
How would the sort of flashlight of this, you know, illuminate that? How would that work?
Well, it's not quite as simple as
I'm sure it's not
shining a flashlight. But what we do know is that the energy scale that's being explored at the Large Hadron Collider is the right energy scale for a particle that could be dark matter. In other words, if there is a particle with that mass that interacts mm-hmm. with the energy set by that scale, we would know how we can predict how much of it should be around today. And of course, it would have to be stable enough to last until today. But we can predict how much of it would be around. And maybe coincidentally, or maybe there's really something underlying it that is the right energy scale. So it could be that when we explore these exotic questions we've been discussing, are there extensions of symmetry or space-time, it could be that we will understand what's out there and that whatever it is actually will tell us what this dark matter particle could be.
Now,
be able to explore the particle physics properties.
What about our interaction with that understanding? Stephen puts it in terms of interstellar travel, but let's say we illuminate what dark matter is and or dark energy. Is that a kind of voila, like figuring out electricity and suddenly you harness a new force and I don't know, people are zipping off to, you know, the far Tortuga of the cosmos? Or is this just stuff for physicists?
Well, you know, right now, I confess, it's probably just stuff for physicists. But I can tell you, when they discovered electricity, it also was, in fact, just a discovery. People didn't realize that it was going to change the face of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not promising that these discoveries will do that. But right now, we're interested in if we found out that there are extra dimensions of space, that's kind of an exciting discovery. And I think it's kind of worth knowing.
Absolutely. But everybody would want to go there or at least think about going there. But maybe that's the wrong way of understanding the extra dimensions.
Well, right now, it's not a question of going there. It's a question of, in fact, it might be a question of those extra dimensions really explaining the properties of the universe that we see.
Mm-hmm.
This question of, for example, of why gravity is so weak. Maybe gravity is concentrated somewhere else in an extra dimension, and it's actually explaining why gravity looks weak here. And that's the kind of thing that we've been thinking about. And so it's not that we're going to immediately be able to harness whatever we discover and apply it. But nonetheless, we're going to learn a lot about what underlies, or we hope we'll learn a lot about what underlies what we see and what we do think we understand.
Let's go to Lynn in Concord, Massachusetts. Lynn, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm just driving through a beautiful autumn, or pre-autumn thing here, and I'm wondering what the relevance to life at this time on this planet is for all this. We've got so many problems to be solved which need fortune and energy and brains. Mm-hmm. And this is sort of a Harry Potter game to me. None of us are going to live long enough to see any. If there's a practical thing, if, you know, 2 cents a gallon gasoline is going to come out or something, but it seems to me a bit frivolous with the amount of energy and money and maybe even risk that's being spent. I'll take an answer off the air. Good job.
Lynn, thanks very much for your call. Lynn Letterman, how do you respond?
Well, that question's been asked since the beginning of science, and science at its frontier is always sort of abstract and doesn't have any obvious applications. But because we keep asking these questions, enormous changes have been made in human life. In the 20s, it was the discovery of how atoms behave, and a subject of quantum theory was developed mostly by European physicists, and it was very abstract. It curls the eyebrows of wise men to understand quantum mechanics, mm-hmm. and yet it accounts for some huge fraction of the total GDP of the advanced countries and the developing countries.
In what form? In what products? Cell phones and computers. And
computers, that's right. It's changed the way humans can live and has given us longevity where we never had it before. It's just had an enormous impact, and yet its beginnings were just as abstract as the fascinations that our theoretical physicists are exploiting and torn by. So science is like that. We have to deal with what we understand, and when that understanding comes, sooner or later, it'll have some application to human life. But we're way at the frontier now with this new machine.
Let's get a call from Rob in Boston. Hi, Rob, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have ever since I first heard about this, I have a really strong safety concern about all this. Heard anything but from black holes to big bangs. And what is the danger and the risk of the Earth or possibly the entire universe imploding?
Right. Rob, thanks very much. I wanted to be sure we came to that because it's been very much out there in the public discussion. Jan 11, how about it? There have been physicists who said there is a danger of... Now, I may put this wrong, but somehow of black holes, small, tiny ones being created by this that would sort of, I don't know, eat the guts out of the Earth and unzip everything and then, you know, just to have it all melting down. I'm not sure how to describe it. What's the risk? Is it real? And how should we think about it?
Well, I think people don't find it very soothing that physicists won't say it is physically impossible. Right.
They will not say that.
They will not say mm-hmm. it's physically impossible. We'll say it's ridiculously unlikely.
And what is that ridiculously unlikely thing?
And so people, I understand that people find that frustrating, but ridiculously unlikely, I mean, I don't know the exact number to compare it to, but let's say I was struck by lightning 17 times on the same day at the same hour for, you know, 17 consecutive days. That unlikely.
But in this case,
it's something that you just don't worry about because it's so absurdly unlikely it's not going to happen.
But help us understand what that thing is. It's not lightning. As I understand it, it's something like the collider cramming so much energy into a tiny volume that it would sort of create pinholes, miniature black holes in the universe. Lisa, is that the highly unlikely fear?
Yeah, so basically what people were thinking about was in theories which have extra dimensions, because gravity can be strong even here from the extra-dimensional gravity, there is some possibility that you can make black holes, which actually from the point of view of physicists is very exciting. In fact, I don't really think we're going to get to the energies where that can happen, but even as a theoretical possibility, mm-hmm. it's extraordinarily interesting. Now, why isn't it dangerous? Well, there's a couple of reasons it's not dangerous. One is that we know black holes decay. So that they wouldn't last forever and just keep accreting matter. So these black holes are so tiny, you can hardly even think of them as black holes. They're really just stuff that sort of collects and then decays away right away. But on top of that, I do want to point out that the people at CERN did take this very seriously. They did actually, even though we know there's a very low probability, in fact, negligible, people went ahead and actually did a study to show that if it were true that these black holes were dangerous, that we wouldn't see the universe the way we see it today because it would have already destroyed, because there are high-energy cosmic rays. There's high-energy stuff out there in the universe, and it would have destroyed stuff that we do know exists. So people did take this seriously, even though we knew that the probability was negligible. And now we know for sure that this is not going to do anything dangerous because we can look out there and see what's already there.
We had this nuclear physicist based in Hawaii, Walter Wagner, who filed a restraining order and injunction against the LHC and U.S. District Court in Hawaii. You know, it's clearly not restrained, but we haven't come to the moment of truth yet, Leon Lederman. That will come when it actually fires all the way up to its full energy.
Yeah, but you can be relieved by the fact that the moon is still there. At least it was there when I saw it last night.
It hasn't been sucked into a black hole yet.
It's been irradiated for 4.5 billion years by radiation much higher than what the LHC will ever achieve. So the fact that the moon is there is very reassuring.
Let's take a call from Jonathan in Plainville, Massachusetts. Jonathan, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Great show. What I'm interested in is string theory. How discoveries made here, hope to be made here, will either bolster or refute a lot of what's been put forward in string theory, because it seems all the theories in physics that people seem to gather on one side or the other, almost like the evolutionists and creationists. It seems to be a very passionate and heated discussion. And in watching the Elegant Universe and then reading the book, in some ways I get the feeling that I'm being sold a bill of goods to explain away things that they don't understand yet.
Yeah, Jonathan, we've got a kind of a principle of that debate here with us in Lisa Randall. Lisa, what about string theory? Give it to us in a nutshell.
So in my book, Warp Passages, I try to answer these questions because there is a huge gap in energy between the scales where you would really test string theory and the kind of energies that the Large Hadron Collider will test. It's high energy compared to anything we've seen before, but it's not yet high enough to establish whether or not string theory is right.
Even the new LHC the new collider's not strong enough? Not high energy?
Well, there are ideas that come out of string theory, such as the idea of extra dimensions, the idea of brains that Jana mentioned a little while ago.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some ideas that could be part of string theory. They could be outside the realm of string theory. But basically, the way I like to look at it is by exploring these higher energies, we sort of know where string theory should be targeted. What should the underlying theory be trying to explain? So right now, we have a lot of open questions. We don't know. But if we found out what's out there, we discovered that there were extra dimensions or brains, and we discovered this exotic symmetry called supersymmetry, that gives us a lot of clues about where we're going.
Do a little
it's not
definition
going to
resolve here on string theory, because I'm sure a lot of people have no idea. I have a sense of a sort of a fibers of matter making up the universe in many more dimensions than those we're normally paying attention to.
So we've been talking about particle physics and looking for particles, and particles are sort of elementary objects, or we believe they were elementary objects, mm-hmm. that have no extent in any dimension.
Mm-hmm.
What strings would be objects that actually are extended in one dimension, and particles would be the oscillations of those strings. So we know particles exist, and you can say, how could we not tell the difference? A string is extended and these particles are just point-like. But the point is that to really test string theory, we'd have to see the additional particles that string theory tells you exist. That is to say, we'd have to see additional oscillations of those strings, and those particles are just too heavy. So we're not going to directly probe those extra particles, most likely, but we could probe some of the other ideas that come along with string theory. And string theory has sort of inspired us to think about ideas like extra dimensions in a sort of new way. And so I would say that, strictly speaking, I'm not doing string theory. I'm doing particle physics that's guided by some theoretical ideas that are out there, and they are worth exploring. But also, we really want to see what it is that we can test at this experiment.
Jenna Levin, Leon Lederman, you're the Nobel Prize winner. I will not interrupt.
I recommend it highly. The difference in the question is between, say, creationism and evolution. One is a science and one is not a science, and that's therein lies the controversy. In the case of controversy on string theory, it's theoretical physicists. We don't know enough about nature so that there are several alternative theoretical ideas that are viable. That's a different kind. That scientific controversy happens all the time until we learn more and we settle for one side or the other or something totally new.
Jen, I could ask questions all day, but here's another one. One theory that out of this accelerator's work may come insight that our universe is not alone, that there's a multiverse, that you could have long-lived Gluinos a supersymmetric partner of the gluon that would be seen as a messenger from the multiverse. What?
Well, there are different ways in which people mean the idea that there could be multiple universes out there. In one sense, what people are talking about is the idea that the universe has more than three spatial dimensions, and we're living on a brain world floating in this higher dimensional space, and there are other brain worlds out there. So you could think of that as one big universe, but it's sort of contrary to our intuition that this is our universe with our set of galaxies, our laws of physics, and this is where we live. And over there, maybe things would look slightly different. Maybe gravity would be stronger or weaker, and so maybe there would or would not be galaxies or life. And so it really does feel like a different universe. And in that sense, you can have this interaction between those worlds. And it's possible to imagine all kinds of interactions. Maybe they collide, maybe they create explosions, but this is all very, really untested yet, really well beyond, I think, the reach of our experiment still. And then there's another sense in which people mean multiverse, which is to say that our universe is like a bubble off of a ginger root, where each of the plumes off of this ginger root are different universes, each with their own Big Bang and their own kind of cosmological history.
General Levin, we're going to have to leave it there, but bubbles off ginger roots and brain worlds and higher dimensional space, I love it, can't get enough. Thank you so much for being with us from Columbia. And it's great to have you. Lisa Randall of Harvard University, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for hosting.
Wonderful to have you. And Leon Lederman, Nobel Prize winner, Director Emeritus of Fermilab, thanks for joining us. We've got with a little more Large Hadron Wrap. Listeners, thanks for being here. Let's stay here and learn. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Oh, yeah.